5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This podcast is brought to you by BetterHelp. Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at The Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of The Wall Street Journal and the Brookings Institution, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. We are delighted to welcome as our special guest this week, Tim Miller of The Bulwark. He is the host of the Daily Bulwark podcast and otherwise star of staging screen. You can see him on MSNBC all the time and various other places. Welcome, Tim. Tim, is this your first time? I know
No.
Maybe when you were not here. I did a guest slot. Slot on Beg. I have done one Beg before. I'm certain of that.
Okay.
I'm just delighted to be here to help bring my temperature down because I just came off of an interview, a debate on the Piers Morgan show that was not a civil discussion ranging from center left to center right. It was an uncivil. It was an uncivil discussion with me and Steven Crowder, who is just one of the worst people out there. And Piers is getting pretty down in the tabloid gutter himself these days. So that was, you know, that was kind of high blood pressure. And I'm trying to get us back to even here with my friends.
Yes, yes, yes. We will work on that. Although our first topic is the the closing arguments of the two campaigns. And so we do have to start, I'm sorry to say, with the hate fest that took place at Madison Square Garden. It was a kind of a reprise of the GOP convention. But if anything, even more vulgar and raw and stupid and puerile and all those things. So Tim, I'm going to start with you. You don't have to, you know, go over everything we saw at that MSG thing, unless you want to. But I want you to talk about, if you would, the little fake controversy that we have now had. You know, you saw the kinds of rhetoric at that Madison Square Garden event, where just for example, one of the speakers said about Hillary Clinton, "She is some sick bastard. What a sick son of a bitch. The whole fucking party, a bunch of degenerates, lowlives, Jew haters and lowlives. Every one of them, every one of them," this person said. That was just one of the speakers. Okay. And then we have this little fake controversy about Joe Biden's use of the term garbage. Admittedly, wasn't great, but what was your reaction to this tempest?
You're right. My blood pressure's back up talking about the Biden gaffe. And I do not like hearing Mona Charon say those words. So
okay, I know, in the future, I'm quoting.
Bill, yeah, in the future, make Bill Galston read the tawdry.
The first use of the F-bomb on the podcast.
And it wasn't
That's true.
And it wasn't
That's true. Yes. And it was only because I'm quoting and you have to get the full flavor
starts,
of what...
That's how it starts, Mona.
I'll get to Biden in a second. But briefly on the MSG thing, because I thought that I want to give a rare compliment since we're doing civil discourse to Nikki Haley, because I think her and Megyn Kelly both astutely pointed out, like, were there any women involved in the planning of this closing argument event at Madison Square Garden? And so when you even have, like, apologists for Trump, like those two, out there saying this, I just think it shows, like, the strategic error. Because in a weird way, Trump himself was, like, pretty normal Trump, you know, and his pitches grotesque in a lot of ways, mass deportations, tariffs, retribution, but he didn't like say anything new or particularly newsworthy. It was his standard grotesqueries, right? And so I think that had the intros just been like some music and then Trump or whatever, I think the coverage would have been very different, right, of the whole thing. And it just it seemed like a big strategic mistake to have the quotes you read, but then the series of others and Stephen Miller, America's for Americans, Americans only, that horrific nativist rhetoric.
By the way, that was a KKK slogan.
Yeah, not surprising.
Americans, America for Americans.
I don't want to look at Stephen Miller's bookshelf, but I think it'd be pretty revealing. So, you know, I think it was a strategic misstep from them. And then you have this Biden situation, and it's just like, Joe Biden shouldn't be talking at all. He should be in private, having meetings, being president. And I think that he's really tangibly harmed the vice president's campaign by, maybe he doesn't actually feel this way, but by projecting to the people around him, to the campaign, that he's sensitive and that, like, that you know, he wants to be included and that he cares about his legacy. And it's just like, once he decided to get out, he needed to let Kamala Harris have as much room to run as possible and run away from him as possible and criticize him and be a grown-up about it. He's the president of the United States. We shouldn't have to care about his feelings. We shouldn't be filling his schedule with stupid, useless things that only have negative consequences. So I agree with you that it's a fake controversy. Like, who knows what he's trying to say? It was very garbled. In my opinion, it was like super garbled nonsense talk, really. But it's unfortunate that we've had to deal with the fallout from that. But I think that it's not exactly a shine of strength from the Trump campaign that, like, they're so desperate to change the topic from their own self wounds that, like, he's out there wearing a ridiculous dumpster truck costume that's like two sizes too big for him and like pretending to be offended about things when his whole political career is about offending others. So on balance, it wasn't helpful from Biden, but I think that you can tell that that's why the Trump campaign is trying to seize on it to get off of the you know, mess of their own making.
Damon, it is a bizarre aspect of the dynamic, though, isn't it, that that Trump and his people do nothing but name call and disparage and describe people as vermin or, you know, enemies of the people and on and on and on. Not careful to make distinctions between ordinary Democrats or politicians. They lump everybody in. And so they get away with it. But this desire to be persecuted or to capitalize on the sense that's out there among some Trump supporters, and I don't even know how many, but that the elites look down on them, the elites hold them in contempt. They think that's their rocket fuel, right? And they're going to seize on any chance. I mean, you know, you saw Trump saying, this is like Hillary's deplorables comment. It's the same thing.
Well, I mean, I will say that I liked him. I was really just eye-rollingly appalled that, like, Biden did this. Like, immediately recognized, like, he just stepped in this. Yeah. Totally unforced mistake. It was so obvious instantly of what this would do. It was the same night that Kamala had her big, very successful, and I think excellent speech in Washington before an enormous crowd. And instead of the news coverage focusing singularly on that, it became this thing. The president just described 47% plus of the country as garbage. And you know, I really don't care what he intended to say. It came out sounding enough like that it was a true unforced error, and it makes me angry at him. I wish he would just shut up. That said, your larger point, yes, of course, is it unfair that the two parties are held to utterly different standards on these things? Yes, of course it is, but that's our time. That's what politics is now, because the fact is that the Republicans, since Trump came on the scene, have decided, and depending on the outcome next week, they could well be right that they win by dividing. The Democrats rightly understand that they win by trying to be as broad as possible. So there are totally diametrically opposed electoral strategies. The Democrats want to win as many votes as possible, take as many people from the center and even the center right as they can to build a coalition that could prove to be a majority of the country. All the Republicans want to do under Trump is to win a plurality plus one of every swing state, which means in their mind, maximizing the total number of their base possible. And this speaks to the whole gender thing that you were asking Tim about too, that Tim brought up with the Nikki Haley comment. It is the case, I think, that they've decided that they can win this if their non-engaged, non-informed, but persuadable male voters out there will be motivated to show up to vote next Tuesday or in early voting, and thereby run up the kind of alienated, white, non-college educated man in the country. And if they can just do that just enough in the seven swing states, then they can prevail. And everyone else, the enemy. That's their strategy. And that translates when it comes to things like media coverage and narratives of the two campaigns, is that like they, you know, the Democrats are expected to be as open and tolerant and accommodating as possible to as many people as possible, to say, please come vote for me, join us. Whereas the Republicans are, it's us or them. Come and join us because they want to kill you. They hate you. They want to destroy you. And totally different strategies. And the consequences are exactly what we saw that night with the Biden comment. And that's the reason why it played exactly into the Republican strategy.
So I think the male versus female vote is probably the heart and soul of the election that we are about to go through. And so I think we should talk about that some more. But before we do, I want to ask you, Linda, are we overplaying the garbage comment from Biden? I mean, that was a hell of a speech by Kamala Harris. 75,000 people showed up. That's a reflection of something. And she's good at those things. And she nailed it, in my humble opinion. What do you think? Are we missing the...
Well, first of all, I want to beg to differ with both Tim and Damon on the Biden thing.
Good. We like differing.
I blame the media. I blame the way the media handled the Biden thing. To me, it was a little nothing. I mean, you've got Donald Trump every single day saying that America is a garbage can. You know, you've got all of the vile things, including about Latinos, which were totally repulsive. This narrative of Latinos and babies, this is the great replacement theory, plus all of the anti-immigration stuff, whose roots, as I mentioned last week in my highlight, start from the anti-population movement. They don't like immigrants because, number one, they're people, and if they happen to be Latinos, they have children, love family, and that apparently is a bad thing. So all of that, I think the media is trying so hard to be even-handed. And they gave a hard time to Trump about the rally at Madison Square Garden. And this was the way to do, well, you know, the both sides kinds of things. And I think the media made it more of an issue than it needed to be. And I guess I did hear the statement. I heard the apostrophe. I heard that it was supporters apostrophe plural apostrophe. Go, you know, I'm an old English teacher. What do you want?
I think if you're an old English teacher, there was a lot of grammatical mistakes in the sentence that would have needed to be corrected in addition to the apostrophe.
That's true.
All right.
Well, anyway,
Thank you for that. So, Bill Galston, do you want to weigh in on this? Do you agree with Linda or with Damon and Tim?
On the one hand, I agree more with Damon and Tim than I do with Linda. On the other hand, I have to confess to a certain impatience with this conversation. We have to decide. What kind of discussion are we having? Are we having an aesthetic discussion, a moral discussion, or a political discussion? And if we're having a political discussion, then the question is not how we react, but rather who is being moved in which direction by the range of stimuli to which they're being exposed. That, to me, at this point, is the serious discussion. And, I frankly am past caring, what Donald Trump and his supporters say, because we're in a period now where American politics is dominated by Gresham's Law. And
just explain Gresham's Law, please.
Gresham's Law is the old principle that if you have good money and bad money in circulation, the bad money will drive out the good money. And economists can give you a brisk explanation as to why that's the case. Think of it as a kind of an arms race where the nature of the competition is not dictated by your desires, but by what the other side does. And if you are saying to yourself, well, what they're doing is aesthetically unappealing or morally troubling, and therefore we will or won't do X, I'm afraid that's not the right way to look at it.
I'm not sure what you're saying. I'm totally confused. What is your point?
Okay. My point is that I think we're wasting a lot of time talking about what happened at Madison Square Gardens. That's my point.
Really?
Yes, really.
Okay, that was the closing argument for the Trump campaign.
No, it isn't.
And it encapsulated exactly the pitch that they are making to voters.
What new does that tell us, Mona? What new does that tell us? We knew that already. Is it surprising to anybody on this show that it was completely over the top? We've been down this road so many times. Let's talk about what's really going on.
Okay. What's really going on?
What's really going on is that this election is slowly drifting away from Kamala Harris. That's what's really going on. And the rest is peripheral. And we have to ask ourselves, we're going to have a serious political conversation. Why is that happening? And is it reversible? I don't care about anything else.
Okay. So tell us more. Why do you think it's slipping away from her?
I think it's slipping away from her, because she has failed to make the most effective argument she could for herself. And I deeply regret that, but I think it's true.
That's interesting. What argument should she have been making?
Well, you have a bunch of people saying we still don't know who she is. That's on her. And why do people not know who she is? Because she hasn't really done what she needed to do to define herself. That's my view. I'm happy to explain it.
What do you think, Tim?
I'll give the counter, and then if Bill wants to, I'd like to hear more what he thinks. But I think that if that is true, that she has not done what she needs to do to define herself in the eyes of the electorate, that's like 95% Joe Biden's fault and 5% her fault. And so I think that there's something to be said for that. I mean, I've been saying for like 2 months now that I do have some complaints about the advertising, in that. I think that there are two useful things that the campaign could do at this point. One is define Donald Trump, continue to define Donald Trump as unacceptable and make people remind the people, not who are engaged political viewers, but who are low information voters or who are high information Nikki Haley voters, those two groups, remind them what they don't like about Donald Trump and make him unacceptable for them as the last thing they remember before they go in. And or two, which is maybe where me and Bill have some agreement, introduce new information about Kamala Harris that would make them feel more comfortable with her. And I think that they've done the first thing pretty well in the paid. And I guess maybe where I disagree with Bill is I think that she's done pretty well on the second thing and given the limited runway that she's had at the debate and in the high profile interviews. I think in the paid, the positive paid has been very kind of gauzy, focus grouped. No offense to our friends at the Focus Group podcast, but message tested, maybe a better word, like kind of she will help take home pay and middle class jobs and like this generic stuff that I just think people just don't even hear like anymore. Mm-hmm. Like when it's in the ad, I think they've wasted a lot of money on that. So I guess that would be an area that I guess not knowing Bill's full argument, potentially concur. I think those are the two main objectives. I think that she herself did both quite well, especially given the limitations. I think the campaign has done one better than the other.
Let's take a moment to talk about mental health. We all have struggles, but they don't have to control us. Therapy can be so helpful. It's not just for people with serious trauma or major illness. We all need a sympathetic, dispassionate listener, someone with experience and perspective who can reassure us that others have the same insecurities, doubts, and fears and have overcome them. Therapy helps us to figure out how our own minds may be holding us back. Ruminating about our worries and conflicts or the many balls we're trying to keep in the air doesn't help. It just contributes to the stress. And self-medicating with booze or drugs is a dead end. Therapy can help unwind your worries and let you be a calmer, happier version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, BetterHelp is a great option. It's incredibly convenient because it's entirely online, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and get started. If that therapist isn't a good fit, you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. It's the gift you give yourself. Make your brain your friend with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/begtodiffer today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/begtodiffer.
Can I have a minute?
Could I step in? Could I? I just want to say something that hasn't been, and that is Kamala Harris and the transsexual issue. And I think that the fact that those commercials, those Trump commercials, run every time there's a sporting event, I mean, they're clearly aimed at male voters. Who I think are probably more uncomfortable on that issue. And she needed a sister soldier moment. And she hasn't given herself that. She might have been able, I don't think she could do it at this point on that issue. She's basically the campaign, not she, has more or less tried to diminish this issue. And clearly it's not a huge issue in terms of the number of people it affected. But some of us have been warning that this is an issue culturally that doesn't sit well with the American people.
First of all, I agree with what Linda just said emphatically. But let me just say, and this is sort of presidential politics 101, with every election, you have to decide at the threshold, is this a let us continue election or is it a change election? This is a change election. And which is why the single most important thing that Kamala Harris had to do was to say in specific terms that people could understand and accept, why am I going to be different from Joe Biden? She has had 3.5 months to answer that question. and she still hasn't. As a matter of fact, and, you know, she has had more than a month to correct the statement that she made on The View when he was, when she was asked where she disagreed and, you know, said quite casually, well, offhand, I can't think of anything. That was, in my judgment, a catastrophic blunder in a change election. And I can tell you this because I have a long memory. If Hubert Humphrey hadn't broken with Lyndon Johnson, he would have had zero chance of winning that election. But by breaking cleanly with him on something that the voters cared about, he almost won the election. And she, you know, she seems to think that she can do a general, I know what the viewer reaction to what I'm saying is going to be. And you'll pile it on, guys.
I assume, you know, Beg to Differ has very kind viewers, no? They have, you have tough viewers?
Our viewers do not, they don't like to hear negative talk about Kamala Harris.
Right. And, but I am well past caring. The campaign has been very well run in every respect except the one that matters the most. That is the strategic concept of the campaign. And I think that is the principal reason why you still have large numbers of people saying that they are not sure who she is.
Can I ask you what you would have differed with them on, just really quick? What expected different? What would you, if you would have given her an issue to separate herself on?
Yeah,
what would you?
I think she should have said, you know what? We waited much too long to do what we finally did this year on the border. There were reasons, but they weren't good reasons. And, and in that respect, we failed the country, and I am going to behave completely differently on that issue. I have learned my lesson. Now, I know what the other side is going to say, but that's not the point. The point is, how are the people that you need to move to your side going to react to an honest admission that you made a mistake and, and a firm statement that you're not going to do it as president that way again as president of the United States? I could give you other examples, but that's a pretty darn good place to start.
So let me bring Damon in here. Damon, Bill says it's, the normal presidential election template is change or not, or keep going with what we've got. Of course, this year it's a lot. It's sort of scrambled because Trump, in a way, is running as an incumbent, or at least he was an incumbent, and he carries all the baggage of his term in office. And she is not exactly the incumbent, though she carries much of the baggage from Biden's incumbency. And even though I think Bill makes a good point about her, I agree that the response on The View was bad. I thought she gave a pretty good answer to it Tuesday night, actually, where she said the issues are different now. And that was a decent, answer to that. Now Bill's not buying it, but in any event, I will take all of that on board and say that, in light of everything, even acknowledging that that's all true, I still think she can win. And I think it's because of the male-female divide and the fact that abortion and women's inherent detestation of Trump could still be more powerful than the incumbent versus change versus more the same dynamic. What do you think?
Obviously she can win. It's tied. I've never seen a race this close. It's not just close at the national level. Every single swing state is within the margin of error. So it absolutely could go to her. It's all about turnout.
For the record, I did not say that she was going to lose. What I said was she could have run a much stronger campaign. It should not be this close.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. But I really, I don't know, my beg to differing on what everyone's been talking about is kind of subtle, because I agree with a lot of stuff and then disagree with some others. And I guess the core of the disagreement maybe comes down to the fact that I don't think she could have run a change election. Yes, I agree with Bill. And here I agree. She should have and could have taken that kind of a stance on immigration, because that issue cuts so badly against the Democrats and her campaign. She could have said exactly what Bill suggested, and I think that would have been good. But that would have been a tactical change, not a strategic change. And I don't believe she can run as a change agent. And not only because she is the current sitting vice president, also because liberalism at our moment is not a change ideology. It is a stay the course ideology. Donald Trump is running for president in this year of our Lord 2024, proposing to bring us back to the late 19th century political economy dominated by tariffs. He floats the idea of eliminating the income tax. He wants to go back to probably the closest analog for where he wants to go on immigration is the 1924 immigration law that shut the doors of the country for 40 years. That is an extreme shift proposal. Like, I've spent my entire adult life as either a professor, a graduate student, or an intellectual studying conservatives and the right. And I have had libertarian friends who for a very long time have said, we need to go back to before the New Deal. That's where the mistake was. And all the, you know, the way the court capitulated after the threat to pack the court, and they said it was all okay. And I've for a long time, the only one on the court who went along with that was Clarence Thomas. And I thought that pretty much proved that he was an extremist and shouldn't be taken that seriously. But the extent to which the Republican Party, surprisingly, because of the influence of Trump and the people he's attracted and brought into the party, is far closer to actually pushing for exactly that in power than I could have imagined 20 years ago. And against that, Kamala Harris is saying, essentially, vote for me and we'll stay the course with the welfare state the way it is, the general presumption that having a liberal immigration policy properly policed and law enforced and so forth should continue, that in general, free trade is good, even if not always, and so forth. And in that respect, I think the most emblematic thing about her campaign has been what is going to amount to, frankly, to speak locally on this podcast, an incredible test of the Bulwark Project, which is basically the Nikki Haley strategy. Woo the remaining Reaganite center-right voters over to the Democratic Party, because they believe in preserving this thing that we've had going in this country for several decades now, since the end of World War II, with post-war liberalism that fought the Cold War, that then had some trouble in the late 60s and 70s with the Democrats wavering, and it gets handed off then to Reagan and Bush and George W. Bush, and now it's gone from the Republican Party, and that gets handed off to the Democrats, and they become the majority party defending the liberal state and continuity. So that's where I disagree with Bill, and it's a pretty high level kind of disagreement. It's over the architectonics going on under the surface. And in that respect, Haley is the conservative in this.
You mean Harris?
Sorry, Harris. Yes. Yeah. I mean, not Harris of 2019, but this Harris. Is a conservative in every meaningful sense, both in the sense of Burkean continuity with the past and also in the sense of like a kind of mild version of Reaganite nationhood and a sense of Americanism. It was as clear as day from her convention speech, and it was echoed in that closing speech this week in Washington. So that's why if this fails, if Trump wins despite that, that's what I mean by a test of the Bulwark Project. If that can't win, that means that the Democratic Party, I think, is in a really bad way. Not in the sense that, like, I mean, it's going to be close either way. In the sense of, like, figuring out what do we do next? How do we combat the 1880s project? Which is,
I'm not taking the blame for this, Al Damon. I'm not taking the blame for this, Al.
You to do it, okay. I would take it as much, because on that, yeah. I am totally with you guys. Yeah. I've been applauding Harris. I mean, I loved the convention, all the patriotism, all the Republicans on the stage. I think that should be the way to win, but we just don't know yet. And the big, you know, the only poll that matters is coming up. We'll
so
see.
Linda, one area in particular where Damon's point is very salient is on foreign policy and on America's global role, where you really do have a remarkable inversion of the two parties. The Democratic Party now sounds so much more like the Republican Party that you and I grew up in. Right. You know, she said right. just Tuesday evening, she said that America must always be the champion of liberty around the world. That's Reaganite. You know, that is,
absolutely
right. And so, I hope, I don't know, but I hope, and I kind of believe too, that there are still enough disaffected Republicans, Reaganite Republicans, people who refuse to vote for Trump in the primaries, who may be swayed by that and abortion and a few other things to make a difference this next week. What do you think?
I hope so. I mean, I hope that those early voting numbers that we're seeing where more Republicans are coming out and voting early represent the kind of Republicans you and I used mm-hmm. to be. And so that's what I'm hoping. I don't, you know, it may be foolish to hope that, but that's what I'm hoping. And you're absolutely right. I mean, unfortunately, most Americans don't vote on foreign policy issues. But, you know, my vote for Kamala Harris was almost entirely, not entirely, but almost entirely based on foreign policy, based on Ukraine, based on Taiwan, based on a sense that NATO has kept the world safe for my entire lifetime. And I think he is a danger in that respect. Unfortunately, most Americans, I think, when they think about foreign policy, buy the Trump nonsense that, you know, gee, the world was, you know, a safe and peaceful place. Tell that to the Syrians when Trump was in office. You know, I don't know. I do think that you talked a little bit about the gender issue, and I do think that is important. And yes, it may be mostly driven on the abortion issue, but here I disagree with Bill a bit that the kinds of issues we've talked about in terms of Trump's denigration of America and his vicious attacks on anyone who disagrees with him, I do think those are going to matter. And I do think women instinctively recoil, particularly with that kind of bombastic fury that he projects. You know, maybe, you know, the Joe Rogan crowd and the, you know, World Wrestling Federation crowd really thinks it's cool. They love that image of his bloodstained face and his fists pumped in the air, you know, having survived an assassination attack. And that's what they're looking for. But I think a lot of women find the name calling and the crudeness and the attack.
I was just going to introduce the gender gap issue for you, tee it up for you. You know, that women vote more than men. Women are also a bigger percentage of the voting age population than men. Isn't it a better bet if you're going to make this a boys versus girls election to bet on the women?
As a matter of pure math, yes, if it comes down to that. But I think politically speaking, it's more complicated. Let me just give a brief history of the three Trump elections. In 2016, there was a huge gender gap because he did a lot better among men and Hillary did a lot better among women. And he did well enough among men to more than neutralize her advantage among women. 2020, and people don't talk about this very much, was quite different. Biden hung on to almost all of Hillary's advantage among women, but came very close to fighting Donald Trump to a draw among men. And that is why he won the election by 7 million votes, 4.5%. The shape of this election is much more like 2016 than 2020. And that scares
me.
Why? Because there's a symmetrical gender gap. And that is, she's doing very well among women, but he's doing equally well among men. So the basic shape of this election looks a lot more like 2016 than 2020. We're talking as though you can go all out to mobilize women without creating some sort of counter-mobilization among men. And that might work if the other side allows you to do that. But the Trump campaign is fighting just as hard for the male vote as Kamala Harris is for the women's vote. And I'm not brave enough to say who's going to come out, with more votes based on that dynamic. But it is not a slam dunk.
No, nothing's a slam dunk.
If it were
sure.
a slam but, dunk, she'd be way ahead.
And oh, no, that's
based
obvious.
Based on phalanxes of angry women. But
agreed. But Tim Miller, so Bill's colleague at Brookings, Elaine K. Mark, with whom he has published many times, wrote recently that if the composition of the electorate between men and women remains the same as it was in 2020, Harris could win Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Nevada. So that's interesting. And the other thing that I would just ask you to comment on is Bill said, that Trump is doing, Harris is doing very well with women. Trump is doing equally well with men. But in addition to what I said earlier about there are more women voters and they're more likely to vote, the male population that Trump is counting on, isn't it the people who are irregular voters? What do you think?
It is. I think that's something the Democrats are obviously banking on, for sure. And I'm worried that 2024, I think it's going to be a high turnout election. The early vote numbers seem good. Linda mentioned earlier that it was seeming to favor Republicans in the early days. I think that's getting less and less the case. But across the board, numbers appear to be up from what people expected. So I think it'll be high turnout. I mean, to Bill's point, Bill makes a good point. I feel like lost in all of this sometimes. I was just pulling this up while he was talking. Among white women in 2020, Trump won by 7. It's I don't know that people that really sinks in with people. Hillary, he only beat Hillary by 2 among white women. So he gained with white women between 16 and 20. So on the one hand, I think that does give Harris potentially room to grow and solve the problem that Bill is talking about, right? Where, if Hillary won women by 15, could she win women by 20? Is that crazy? 18, could she nudge that up just enough to offset the losses with men? I do think that's possible, but I think that the reality of the situation is there's a huge group of white working class women that have not responded in the same way as women of color and college educated white women. Now that said, this is also our first post Dobbs election. So maybe some of that isn't showing, you know, it's possible. It's this is a little bit cope, you know, and hopium. I don't have it. It's like there's no data to prove this, but it is certainly possible that there are white working class women who are kind of in the inverse shoes of their husbands in 16, right? Like who weren't talking to pollsters about how they're for Trump because it wasn't in vogue, you know, whatever. Lack of trust wasn't in vogue. Maybe there's some women out there that could help her numbers up. Can I just make one other point on Damon's comment from earlier? Because it was so good. I do totally agree with everything Damon was saying about how it would be very hard for her to be the change candidate, just given the nature of what she represents versus what he represents. Like, isn't it crazy? I was about to cuss on his podcast. Isn't it crazy that we are here right now? I hear what Bill is saying about how it's a change election, but like, things are basically fine. Like things are basically, they're not great. There are problems, but they're within a normal band of problems that we've had throughout all of history right now. And like the idea that this is the moment that you would turn to somebody that is promoting the most radical overhaul of our domestic and foreign, the way that that we govern ourselves domestically and the way that we engage with the world. Like he's promising the most radical overhaul of that of any major party presidential candidate in any of our lifetimes. And there were times of a lot more upheaval before this. And I still continue to find it like unbelievably remarkable that has been effective. But I think that is kind of explains the buy-in that she's in, right? That it's like, it's kind of hard to, if people really do want that type of upheaval, you know, even like a little bit of distancing from Biden here or there, like, is that really going to help? I don't know. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of expand on Damon's comment there.
And if I could just briefly note here, I'm teaching a course on conservatism this semester at Penn, and we've finally gotten up to Reagan, and so I showed them Reagan's first inaugural address yesterday in class, and first of all it was like, you know, compare his rhetoric to Trump's rhetoric, quite something, but to set it up, I just wrote on the board, like, unemployment rate, 1980-2024, interest rates, inflation rate, and I forget what the fourth one was, but, you know, and then, of course, also reminded them about the Iranian hostage situation that had been going on. Like, the difference between now and then, you would think that we were living in like a utopia right now. Like, like back then, unemployment was 7.5%, interest rates were 15.8%. You know, inflation
the
was
misery
7.5.
Index. That's why they came up with the term misery index.
Yeah, stagflation, or something we haven't heard since. I mean, it was really quite bad right then. And the result of that change election was the election of Ronald Reagan. And now we're in this weird kind of bozo upside down world where everything on paper looks pretty good. And I know Bill, you know, Bill and I also agree that things aren't as great as they seem. There are differential benefiting, you know, people benefiting in different ways and not adequately. And there have been all kinds of structural changes with deindustrialization and other things that are worth saying and are real and have something to do with why Trump does as well as he does. And yet still at the kind of macro level, you would think that we would want the most stable continuity election imaginable because the unemployment rate can't get lower.
That's right.
The inflation rate now finally can't get lower, even though we did have inflation just a couple years ago. It was as high as 9.1%. But again, it was 15% in 1980. So it's quite astonishing. And it's been interesting. And of course, Bill wants to come in on that.
Yeah. Sure, Bill.
Look, you know, I think to have an adequate discussion of the framework that Damon has laid out would take a whole nother show and then some. Suffice it to say, I think you have dramatically oversimplified the situation that we now face. Details to come.
All right. Okay. Duly noted. I want to.
But Mona, if I can just say.
Oh, sorry.
If I can just say one more thing.
Sure.
It doesn't matter whether people like us think things are going just fine in the country, right? The real question is what the American people think. And I have rarely, if ever, seen right track or wrong track numbers to equal the sustained depths that we have seen during this presidential campaign. So we have to ask ourselves whether we are using the right metric. I found it interesting that when Damon, you know, went to the chalkboard, everything he put on it was economic. Maybe that's not the pivot of elections anymore. Maybe we're having a cultural contest and not an economic contest, in which case the metrics have to be completely different. I could go on. I just think that we, you know, and I've been struggling to do this now for 10 years as a scholar. We really need to ask ourselves some hard questions about why, if we think things are going pretty well, so many people disagree with us. We can say they're wrong or misguided, but I think that gets us nowhere analytically, and especially nowhere politically.
Okay, well, that's interesting. And I think we do need to devote more attention to the cultural divide in our country. It's something that I'm very interested in and I've written about. And so that definitely deserves a lot more attention. I'm less of a fan of the right track, wrong track polling data, just because I think it's so noisy. You can't tell when people say wrong track whether they mean, you know, whether they are strong, let's say, MAGA Republicans who, you know, think there's too much wokeness, or whether it's, you know, people who think we have too much conservatism. So anyway, it's a little bit, I think that's less helpful, though not completely irrelevant. Did you know that your personal data is out there on the internet and that people are hunting it down like prized collectibles? Well, we've got the scoop on that. Incogni is a service that helps protect your personal data from data brokers who collect, aggregate, and sell it. The issues arising from this include increased spam, identity theft, and loss of control over your personal information, all of which is exacerbated by the frequent data breaches that we're always getting emails about. Incogni addresses these problems by contacting data brokers on your behalf to request the removal of your personal data, handling any objections from data brokers, and continuously monitoring and ensuring your data stays off the market with repeated removal requests. So don't wait another moment. Secure your data with Incogni. This cutting-edge service doesn't just fend off pesky data brokers, but also expertly handles any objections they may raise. And if you've got a circle of friends or family who could use some added protection, Incogni's plan allows you to include up to 4 additional people, all benefiting from the same high-level security. Head over to incogni.com, that's incogni.com, to start your journey to a spam-free and secure online experience. Plus, with a 30-day trial and a full refund guarantee if it's not to your liking, there's no reason not to give it a go. Stay tuned for more updates on keeping your data safe and sound. Take your personal data back with Incogni. Use code BEGTODIFFER at the link below and get 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/BEGTODIFFER. I do want to get to our oligarch masters just for a few words here, because it was really notable this week and quite disturbing to see people, you know, these billionaires who have made the cool calculation that it's best to, you know, either rebuild or build their ties to Trump, even if that means sacrificing other values, because they are, you know, principally concerned for their own bottom lines. Linda, I'm going to go to you. You know, this decision by Jeff Bezos and Patrick, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, Patrick Soon-Shiong, who is the publisher of the LA Times. They both had their editorial departments had teed up endorsements of Harris. They both killed them. You saw a gathering of the Business Council, which is an invitation-only association of chief executives out in California, where they were all discussing, you know, how important it is to make nice with Trump. And of course, you have Elon Musk, who is almost in a category all by himself in terms of influence and nefarious, frightening amount of power, being all in for Trump. And you wonder in that relationship, who is the puppet master and who is the puppet?
Well, I think, you know, I'm reminded of the Lenin quote that, you know, capitalists would sell, you know, the rope to hang them with. I'm butchering that, but you get
when it comes
point.
Time to hang the capitalists, they will sell us the rope.
They will sell us the rope. That's yeah. Right. Okay. So, and I think it really does harken back to something we discussed a couple of weeks ago on the broadcast, and that was corruption and the likely corruption that will take place during a second Trump term. It isn't really about bottom lines, because all of the people you've recommended, yes, they, you know, they care about bottom lines. Well, mostly what they care about is their yachts and their homes in, you know, many various places. It's about personal wealth. They are indeed oligarchs. And oligarchs flourished in the wake of the breakup of the former Soviet Union, and did very well until some of them didn't and ended up falling mysteriously out of windows. So I think they're making a devil's bargain here. But I do believe that because so many of them are involved in one way or another in the media infrastructure in our country, that goes a long way to explaining why you have discomfort with the comfort with the right track, wrong track polling. Because I think we don't get information in the way we used to. We don't get it from a common source. And I think that is one of the reasons, you know, we sit here and cite statistics. It isn't just the lived experience of people that are feeling this differently. It is that they are fed a constant stream of disinformation about what is happening in this country. So it's scary to me. They are going to, if Trump is elected, we're going to look a lot more like post-breakup Russia than anything we have ever seen in American history.
Tim, can I ask you about the journalism side of this? You know,
sure.
Journalism is struggling, right? Newspapers closing all over the place. The economic model, which used to be, you know, the big department store and supermarket chain would advertise in the local paper, and that was their revenue source. And then, right, that's all gone, blown up. And so many papers have closed, and a few papers have been sort of rescued by these billionaires, including Washington Post, by Amazon's Jeff Bezos. And that's great, because he's got more money than God, and he doesn't need to worry about the declining ad revenue, except he's got a lot of other business interests, and he's got contracts with the federal government that he's got to be concerned about. And so we wind up here where he decides, actually, you know, the Post is a money losing proposition for him anyway. And the most important thing he's interested in are his business contracts, you know, his other businesses and their contracts with Uncle Sam. So what does this say about journalism?
We could do another hour symposium in addition to the cultural changes in the country on what's happening in journalism and how, like, the New York Times is becoming a monopoly that's gobbling up everything, and everyone else needs to exist based on charity and the problems associated with that. And there are many problems associated with it, which is why I've been more hesitant to be excited about the unsubscribe for the Washington Post thing. I think that supporting actual journalism on net is good. To me, it's more of a question about what you were alluding to there with these guys and their relationships with the government. I mean, all of the accusations from the right over the years about Soros are true in spades about Musk in mm-hmm. times 100, right? Like, he's involving himself in these campaigns, and he is a government contractor, and he's looking for favors from the government, and like, he's going to try to attack, you know, use crony capitalism to hurt his competitors. I mean, like, it's all of the bad things every you know, sort of free market, whatever, Republican would say about lefty billionaires getting involved in our politics. That's a problem. And then Bezos is not as active as Trump, but the same motivations are there, right? You know, you have his Blue Origin or whatever it is, those people meeting with Trump. So, I mean, it's deeply alarming. And, I appreciate Bill's generosity towards the American people and their motivations and why they are saying things are bad when objectively things are good. I'm for that. I do not share that generosity when it comes to these billionaires. It's what they're doing is idiotic and selfish. And it, as Linda pointed out, it's a bet that's likely to fail. I mean, like, this, the system of the country moving more towards looking like Hungary is not a system for economic prosperity. And the risk of all of the overhaul of the system that Trump is planning, like, it seems to me that it would be both morally, politically, and capitalistically correct to clearly support Kamala Harris's effort in this campaign, and yet these guys are making a cowardly choice that I think is probably not even in their self-interest in the long run. It's really depressing.
Yep. Damon, have anything to add?
Yeah, depressing. I mean, the only thing I have to add on this is that I think this is yet another way in which the Republican Party of today is remarkably focused on trying to recreate the late 19th century. I wrote a post about this about a week ago, and it had a number of kind of dimensions in which I think this is happening. I mentioned earlier immigration, tariff, kind of political economy based on tariffs, wanting to get rid of the income tax. But another way is a kind of wanting to create a digital version of the Gilded Age. I mean, I think the Bezos thing I put a little bit in a different category. That is a kind of, I think, low level corruption, in the sense that he has this Blue Origin rocket company. It's not as prominent as Musk's SpaceX, and so he's a direct competitor on that. Musk is very close to Trump now, and he's trying to hedge against the consequence of a Trump win by sort of laying off a little bit. And I don't think that's good, and it's not good for the Washington Post or journalism, but I also think that's sort of like more like the kind of corruption one would expect in the early 21st century. The whole Silicon Valley dimension of this, though, the Musk, the Peter Thiel, all the lesser oligarchs out there who are now fervently pro-Trump, that's something a little scarier. I mean, that is the kind of digital Gilded Age model, where a lot of these people, they go look back at the economic history of the country and they say, this was the era of takeoff, of dynamism, where these great individuals created industrial America. And we want to do that now with our new technologies, and we will be the new Carnegies, the new Mellons, the new Roosevelts, the Fords, all of the big industrialists of the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And that's the future of America, is radical dynamism. And Trump is gonna, if you'll excuse a little bit more vulgarity, he's the one who'll break shit and make that possible. And so we're hitching our wagon to him. That, I think, is their motivation, and that is something that we haven't seen before. Again, that's why I think Bezos is more like, yeah, okay, yeah, you wanna, again, hedge in the face of something that could be really devastating to your rocket company. Again, not good, but sort of standard issue corruption. Whereas whereas the Silicon Valley is almost like a kind of counter ideology to what America has become since roughly the progressive era, when the government started to kind of push back against the things that came out of the negative side of the the Gilded Age, breaking up the trusts that inevitably arise when you have very high tariffs and then collusion among different sectors of the economy based on the imports that they require. And so they lobby the government and get a carve out for just them, and so that they don't have to pay the tariffs. It's a kind of model of political economy that we're not really familiar with, and they want to recreate it, and it's a wild thought, and really pretty scary if you think about the kind of changes it would bring in.
So a lot of people, Bill Galston, and you know this, but many don't. A lot of people think a progressive is somebody who is for radical redistribution of income and who is woke and very into identity politics and so on. That's the modern definition of progressive. But the original progressives were exactly the reaction to the great the industrialists of the late 19th and early 20th centuries in this country, and who, political reformers who wanted to take power away from the elites. So we may perhaps be headed back in that direction, strangely enough, if Trump, God forbid, is elected next week. Do you have a thought about this whole, because we were talking earlier about culture, and the Silicon Valley people really represent one of the weird cultural phenomena that's out there. It's almost nihilistic. I mean, they are almost anarchistic. They see themselves as the new masters of the universe, and they are going to be running things with their superior intelligence and gads of money.
Well, they've thought that, like many people before them, of great wealth, and whatever direction politics takes, it usually has some nasty surprises for the would-be masters of the universe. So, famously, in the early Weimar Republic, the great industrialists thought that Hitler would be a useful idiot. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that they were the idiots, and they weren't even very useful. And it's also the case. I mean, your reference to the progressive era is very much, on point. That the masters of the universe of that time really thought that they could control the Republican Party and control the destiny of the country, and very quickly a countervailing force emerged that broke up a lot of their great empires. That's, the origins of the antitrust movement and all of that, et cetera. So in a democracy, ultimately, the masters of the universe are going to get their comeuppance. And guess what? In an autocracy, the same thing happens to them. So they very rarely end up in the place that they thought they were going to be when they made their political choices. But this would be another very long conversation.
All right. Well, we will leave it there for now. We all have to do our best to, do yoga or whatever it is you do to calm yourself between now and whenever the election is decided next week. It may not be Tuesday. It may be Tuesday evening. We'll see. But as the final segment tonight, this afternoon, let's get to our highlight or lowlight of the week, Linda Chavez.
I'm glad you came to me first, because I'm going to pick up on this Gilded Age theme and tell you, what do I do to escape from politics? I read novels. And I'm just finishing the third of Edith Wharton's great series about the Gilded Age, the House of Mirth, finished the Age of Innocence just before that. And last year, my first Wharton novel was The Custom of the Country. So if you want to see what the Gilded Age was like, read Edith Wharton. But I do have a highlight for this week. Some good news in the Chavez-Gersten household. My kids grew up being Dodgers fans. My son Pablo was such a Dodgers fan that when I announced for the United States Senate in the state of Maryland, in Baltimore, he wore a Dodgers jacket to my announcements. That's the kind of Dodgers fans we are. So very pleased in the Chavez-Gersten family at the Dodgers win in the fifth of the World Series. And that at least brought a smile to some of our faces this week when there wasn't a whole lot to smile
at. All right. Thank you. Tim Miller.
We're just doing highlights and lowlights?
Yep. Okay. You can do one or both or neither.
Great. Well, I think that my highlight and my lowlight was Donald Trump dressed up as a garbage man Oompa Loompa with face makeup that was so badly contoured that the bronzer around his cheek then met like a very white area around his lips, so he looked like a blow-up doll of a certain type. And that was enjoyable. It also was a dark reflection on the state of affairs in our politics. So can something be a highlight and a lowlight at the same time? I think so.
I think so, too. Okay. Bill Galston.
Well, as someone who was born in Brooklyn, Linda, I yield to no one in your family. And the very worst man in the universe, I believe, to this day, you know, is a man who should be in the lowest circle of hell, namely Walter O'Malley. And I think that for all sorts of reasons.
Wait, is he the one who took the Dodgers to L.A.?
Yes. Ooh! And my grandparents lived in Sheepshead Bay within walking distance of Ebbets Field. It's all very deep, very, very deep. But, you know, getting on to the low light, there was reference previously to the Bulwark Project. And, you know, one might have thought that someone like Nikki Haley would have turned out to be one of the leaders of the project. But no. You know, here was the closing argument for Trump she delivered earlier today in Pennsylvania. Okay, step one, we have to elect Donald Trump because if Donald Trump wins Pennsylvania, Dave McCormick wins Pennsylvania. Now, that's one of the less impressive arguments I think I've ever heard. But getting serious, she urged Pennsylvania voters to, quote, take all the emotion out of the race. That's a direct quote. And what she meant by that was, forget about everything you hate about Donald Trump. And instead, tell this to yourself. I quote, as a voter, I put my priorities on a president who's going to have the backs of our allies and hold our enemies to account. Duh. You know, who would secure the border? No more excuses. A president who would support capitalism and freedom, a president who understands we need less debt, not more debt.
Oh my!
This God. The same president who added $8 trillion to the national debt.
God,
I hate her so much.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is, you know, this is. I don't even know what to say about
bad faith all the way down.
Expected.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed.
I'm going to be in the old folks' home, pointing my little bony finger at people and be like, that person, Nikki Haley. She almost sent us down to authoritarianism. That ugh, I hate these people.
Damon Linker.
Well, Permit me to explain something. This is going to be a low light, but I'm starting with a prelude to the low light. The Democrats released an ad this week in which a couple of it's implied Republican couples are going to vote, and the men vote, and then they say, "Yes, dear, now you go." And then the women go in and they vote, and Julia Roberts is doing the narration. And basically, it portrays the women as like basically captives of a hostage situation, or like they're citizens in a totalitarian regime and they don't know what to do. And they make eye contact and they decide, yeah, basically, we're in secret here voting. We can vote for Kamala Harris, even though our husbands are making us vote for Trump. Now, I didn't like this ad. I found it kind of condescending and obnoxious in the way that political ads often can be. This is not aimed at me as a voter, really. But what I found very interesting, and here we get to the lowlight, Charlie Kirk, Jesse Waters, and even these are two, right-wing influencers,
MAGA
people who I spend all their days on cable news, on Fox and other places. And then even Matthew Crawford, who's one of my favorite conservative kind of intellectuals of the moment, have all kind of weighed in on this ad. And they see it as this insidious, not kind of condescending and laughable thing, which I think is the appropriate response if you don't like it, but they are implying that this is the Democrats trying to get into your marriage and steal your wife from you. And they don't seem to realize that they have, in doing so, vindicated the most insidious interpretation of the ad.
Yes.
Because they're implying that the women are captives of a totalitarian regime run by their husbands, and that this is bad, that they should let their husbands rule over them and tell them how to vote.
Great.
And so this is like the end, final like collapse of the argument here. And I think it proves the ad has done its effective work. And despite my not liking it, well done.
Excellent. Okay. I would just like to note this in a different political year when there was less at stake, it would just be a nice little funny thing. But this year it's kind of necessary to laugh at something, which is there is a candidate, Republican candidate for Congress in Virginia by the name of Derek Anderson, who posed for campaign materials that were distributed in his district. He posed with someone else's wife and children. Made a nice little family tableau and put this out. He's not married. He doesn't have kids. I mean, it was just wow. So hats
the opponent
off to
of
him.
Our friend Eugene Vindman, Alex Vindman's brother.
That's correct. That's yes. Right. And so go out and vote for Eugene Vindman if you're in that district against people stealing. There's stolen valor and this is, stolen family values or something. I don't know. But all right. With that, I would like to thank our guest, Tim Miller, and my regulars, Bill Galston, Damon Linker, and Linda Chavez, and our producer, Jim Swift. Deep breath. Beg to Differ will return next week, as every week, no matter what happens.